Chapter 12, Three Thrusts to the Heart. Freya's army left Three Hills in triumph, cheered by those whose age or wounds prevented them from joining their queen. 3,000 warriors marched or rode southeast through the rolling landscape, moving quickly towards the River Aver, the watercourse that effectively divided Azeborn lands from those of the Burgundians. Within 3 days, the army came within sight of the mighty river that ran from the World's Edge Mountains through the Empire before emptying into the sea at Marburg. Here, the coming winter had made the landscape flat and hard, ideal for chariots and cavalry, and the army moved into marching column as it followed the river east towards the river crossing at Avastrun. Despite the grim skies that wreathed the world in bleak twilight, the army's spirits were high. Freya was an inspirational presence, taking many lovers en route and ensuring that overblown, erotic tales spread through the camp quicker than a dose of the pox. As always, Freya led from the front, her black and gold chariot unmistakable among the less ornate chariots of the Azeborn warriors. With the river on the army's right flank, Azeborn horse archers galloped wide, while the heavier lancers rode closer to the main body of the infantry and chariots. By noon of the fourth day of the march, Freya sent word back down the line that she had spied the river crossing and their enemy. Blocking the crossing were 1,000 dead warriors in ancient armour, arranged like a row of obsidian statues in a mausoleum. All were clad in rusted bronze, the weak light glinting from the corrosion on the rings of their mail. An eldritch green light glimmered in the empty eye sockets of each warrior, and 100 knights sat on skeletal horses on either flank. Flocks of carrion birds gathered for the feast, and the few trees in the scattered patches of woodland were thick with screeching bats. A warrior in gleaming silver armour sat upon a hellish steed at the centre of the host, black wings like smoke billowing from its flanks. Khalid Al Montasur was an incongruous sight amid this army of darkness, and his wondrous form drew all the light to him, such that he shone like a legendary hero of old. Freya wasted no time in arraying her army for battle, issuing orders with customary fire and fury. The Azeborn infantry moved into four blocks of 500, spears and swords held in fists that demanded vengeance for the loss of the Burgundians at Menegoths. With the chariots thrown out before her main battle line, the heavy horse rode out to the flanks, ready to roll up the line of the dead warriors. Bare-chested horse archers whooped and yelled as they rode around the army of the dead, loosing flurries of arrows into the massed ranks of skeletal warriors. Though the dead had no flesh to damage or organs to pierce, the barbed shafts felled them just as surely as they would a mortal man. Intended to provoke a reckless charge rather than inflict mass casualties, the arrows of the horse archers did little but fell a few score of the dead warriors. Ululating Azeborn war horns signalled the advance, and the infantry moved forward, moving at a brisk trot to cover the ground between the two armies. Freya led the advance, her chariot thundering towards the serried ranks of the dead with hundreds more behind her. The hard ground threw up no dust with their passage, and the entire army witnessed the horror of what happened next. Before Freya's horn blew to signal the turn, Khalid Al Montasur aimed his sword at the earth before the charging chariots. The hard ground cracked and split as hundreds upon hundreds of dry, fleshless corpses clawed their way to the world above, dust and earth spilling from their empty skulls and open jaws. Unable to stop or turn, the chariot slammed into them with a tremendous crash of dried bone and wood. Azeborn chariots were never meant to be run straight into the enemy, but raced along the front of a foe's formation. Archers would loose arrows into the faces of the enemy at point-blank range, and spear-bearers would hurl heavy, iron-tipped shafts into the warriors pressing in from behind. To run a chariot straight into the foe would certainly kill a great many of the enemy, but would, more often than not, destroy the chariot and kill the riders and horses. The chariots came apart in a screaming bray of pain, both animal and human. Most simply shattered in the impact, but some overturned, crushing their crews and breaking the horses' legs. The queen's chariot vanished in a crash of shattered timber, broken apart by the violence of the impact. Hundreds more were destroyed in explosions of splintering timber, hurling their crews to the ground or breaking them beneath the wheels of those behind them. Only the quickest crews were able to avoid the catastrophic collision of dead bodies and screaming horses, but in doing so, they bled off the speed that kept them safe. Grasping skeletons clawed their way onto the chariots, attacking with broken swords or cudgels salvaged from the vast swathe of wreckage left by the destruction of the chariots. Khalid al-Muntasir swept his sword up, and hundreds of rotten-fleshed wolves burst from the ranks of the dead warriors at the river. They fell upon the struggling Azabons with dreadful hunger, jaws tearing open throats and claws raking warm flesh from the bone. The warriors, blocking the river crossing, marched forward in dreadful unison, each bony footfall crashing down at the same time as they fell upon those the wolves hadn't yet killed. Swords and spears stabbed and slashed with mechanical precision, and the entangled Azabons were cut down without mercy. Freya's shield maidens dragged her bloodied body from the wreckage, fighting with all the fury of berserkers as the rest of the army raced forward to rescue their fallen queen. The black skeletons chopped through the ruin of the chariots, killing anything living they could find. Azabon cavalry charged towards the flanks of the dead army, but the corpse knights wheeled their skeletal mounts and raced towards them as hundreds of leathery winged bats launched themselves from the trees. Green fire flickered around the undead knights, their blades shimmering with ghostly light, and the two forces met in a thunderous clash of iron. Azabon lances smashed through ancient armour, splintering as the weight of the dead broke them apart. Screeching bats tore at the Azabon riders, clawing their faces and entangling their blades with their wings and stinking bodies. Both forces of horsemen swirled together, hacking at one another with swords and axes, but within seconds it was clear the Azabon charge was doomed. In the centre of the battle, Khalid al-Muntasir danced through the fighting, his gleaming sword slaying all it cut. No weapon could touch him, no warrior lay him low, and he slid through the scattered Azabons like a ghost, leaving a trail of bodies in his wake. Tattooed warrior women of the Myrmidian sects formed a ring of screaming fury around him, but within moments all were dead, gutted, beheaded, or fatally pierced by his quicksilver blade. Malign clouds of sable light billowed around the blood drinker, a miasma of dark sorcery that drained the life from any who came near him and animated the corpses of those he had killed. The ranks of the dead swelled with every passing moment, for the newly slain rose up to attack their former comrades, bloodied and mangled charioteers clawing at men and women they had broken bread with only that same morning. The encircling horns of the dead army began to envelop the Azabons, but even at this desperate moment, the battle could have been saved. At that critical moment, when one spark of heroism or fear could have turned the tide of the fighting, a warrior named Daigle, a lad no older than 12 summers, who had trained and fought with Maeve, turned and fled from the horror of the bloodletting. His sword and shield forgotten, Daigle ran in blind terror, and his panic spread to those around him. Within moments, hundreds of Azabons were fleeing the battle, desperate to escape the slaughter and frantic to live. The battle line collapsed as the fragile courage of the mortal army broke in the face of this nightmare horde. But there was to be no such easy escape. The dread knights rode down the fleeing Azabons, trampling them beneath the pellucid fire of their mounts' hooves, or chopping them down with pounding blows of their swords. The encircling army of the dead surrounded the dying Azabon host, drawing it into a black embrace of massacre. Only a handful of mortals escaped the slaughter, the queen's shield maidens and 100 or so warriors who had been first to flee. Their shame burned almost as hot as the relief that they still lived, and as darkness fell, barely a tenth of the queen's army escaped into the hills. Khalid al-Muntasir stood triumphant, his army arranged across the battlefield in silence as the crows and ravens pecked the choicest morsels from the defeated army. The blood drinker let them have their feast. For what could be more terrifying to a mortal warrior than to later face one of his own kind with eyes pecked out, flesh partially eaten, and tongue hanging loose on rotten sinews? As Morslieb slipped from behind the clouds to bathe the blood-soaked field in its rich emerald moonlight, He uttered the words given to him by Nagash and laughed long into the night as the vanquished Azaborns rose to their feet once more. Without any orders needing to be issued, the army of the dead arrayed itself for march, moving in deathly silence and utter precision as they followed the route Queen Freya's doom army had taken. Back towards Three Hills. Volleys of arrows flew overhead, slashing down the causeway and slicing into grey, lifeless flesh. Bordan's foresters loosed more arrows, and another clutch of the dead were felled. The viaduct from the ground was thick with dead warriors, partially decayed men and women lurching and swaying towards Middenheim with horrid purpose and grotesque hunger moaning from their slack jaws. "Gotta hand it to Borden's men," said Holstef, the beast-horned clarion clutched tightly in his gauntleted fist. "They're killing everything they hit." Ustern grunted. "They can't miss. Even I could loose an arrow that would slay something."
"Probably one of us," added Leovulf, undoing the leather thong that held his black hair.
"You cut me deep," said Ustern, tapping smouldering ash from the end of his pipe. Redwane let them talk. It was their way of easing the tension before a charge. Though the White Wolves feared no living foe, the horde arrayed before them today was something much worse. Redwane had fought the living dead before, but the same fear was still there, still poisoning his gut with a sour bile taste. The thoughts that had haunted him on the march towards Brass Keep returned to him anew. The dread of dying alone, the fear that his best years were already behind him, and that he was on a grim descent into dotage and infirmity. Redwane took a deep breath, looking to the sky in a bid to cast off such gloomy thoughts, but he found no refuge there. The sky above the Fauchlag Rock was as black as his mood. It had been that way ever since the dead had isolated Middenheim from the Empire. The noose had closed slowly, with villages blotted out one by one, and the steady stream of traders, mercenary companies, and pilgrims diminishing until it was impossible not to see that something terrible was developing in the haunted forest surrounding the city. Despite his dislike of the man, Bordan's foresters had quickly discovered the roads cut by lurking bands of the dead and packs of fiery-eyed wolves. The villages and camps around the city were hastily evacuated, their people brought within Middenheim's walls. Even Torbricken's band of lunatics had come into the city, which had surprised Redwane until he remembered that they had foreseen their deaths before the walls of Reichdorf. Despite his insistence that no one be left beyond the city, Redwane suspected that Mercer was already regretting his decision to allow the self-mutilating madman into Middenheim. They marched through the streets, preaching their prophecies of destruction and pain, while whipping themselves into maniacal frenzies. No warriors could be spared from the fighting to stop them, and the mood in the city soured as more and more of Middenheim's citizens joined in their cavalcade of blood. "If they're so eager for death, I say we help them on their way. Give them a sword and stick them on the walls," Redwane had muttered at one of Mercer's war councils, and few disagreed with him. Yet, for all their apparent lust to die, the madmen refused to take arms to defend Middenheim. Clearly they weren't insane enough to want to die just yet. Within a day of the gates closing, the living dead host swallowed the lands around Middenheim, throwing themselves at the fortresses clustered around the city and the chain lifts. Those bastions still held, but the horde had soon discovered another way up. Led by shadowy, dark-cloaked figures on black steeds, skeletal warriors armed with spears, axes and swords climbed the great viaduct towards the city. Frothing, blood-hungry corpses scrambled up the rocky sides of the Fauchlag Rock, and Orsa's city defenders had their hands full, hacking them down as they reached the summit. Trapped beyond the walls, Wolf's Mountain Pathfinders had tried to cut through the dead towards the viaduct, but they had been overrun before making it halfway. Redwane had watched as the Mountain Lord was dragged down and eaten by wiry, hairless things with tearing claws and distended jaws. Orsa led a party of axemen to retrieve the bodies of their fallen comrades, but had been beaten back without success. Now Wolf marched with the dead, his ravaged flesh hanging from his bones in rotten strips. His warriors fought beside him, as loyal in death as they had been in life. It had been a blow losing Wolf, for he had been well liked, and the tale of his ending had circulated to become a macabre scare story, growing in horror with every retelling.
"They'll be calling for us soon," said Leovulf.
"Expect you're right," said Astern.
Redwayne looked towards the fighting raging at the head of the viaduct. Since the war against the North Sea, a more permanent defensive barrier had been built across the head of the viaduct, a curved wall flanked by two drum towers and with a heavy gate of Drakwald oak and good northern iron at its centre. Atop the walls, Count Mercer led the defenders in battle, the Runfang cleaving glowing arcs through the ranks of the dead. None of them could resist it, the dwarf forged blade slicing through mouldering bones, rotted armour and decayed flesh with its runic edge. To see so magnificent a weapon borne by such a hero lifted the hearts of all who fought beside him. Mercer's banner-bearer battled alongside him, the blue and ivory standard soaked and limp. No wind stirred the fabric, and instead of lifting the spirits of those who saw its colours, it only served to remind the warriors of Middenheim of how grim their situation truly was. The dead swarmed the defensive wall, scaling its rugged surfaces with bony claws, digging into the stonework in a way no living warrior could manage. They fought with a speed and ferocity Redwayne remembered all too well, dragging men from the battlements and pushing through any gaps in the line. Mercer and Renward commanded the defenders on the viaduct, while Bordan and his men occupied the high ground behind the walls. Perched on rooftops, clock towers and watchposts, the foresters thinned the dead host as best they could. Orsa's men patrolled the city, hunting down any dead warriors that found their way through the caves that honeycombed the rock or successfully scaled its sides. Redwayne had defended this city once before from an attacking army, but this felt very different. Then he had been one of Sigmar's warrior companions, but now he was part of Middenheim's defence, a city that was not his by birth. As much as Sigmar might declare that all men of the Empire were as one, he couldn't shake the feeling that he ought to be in the south, fighting to protect Unberogen lands. This city wasn't his, no matter what oaths he had sworn to Mercer and the White Wolves.
"Redwayne," hissed Leovulf, leaning in close.
"What?" he muttered absently.
"You're our leader, so damn well lead," said Leovulf.
Redwayne snapped out of his gloomy reverie and nodded, ashamed he had allowed his mind to wander when he needed to focus now more than ever.
"Aye, sorry," he said, looking towards the walls for Mercer's signal.
"Whatever is in your mind, deal with it later," said Leovulf. "They'll be looking for us soon, and we need you with us."
"You're right," he said, holding himself tall in the saddle. He unhooked his warhammer and slipped the leather thong at its base around his wrist.
The White Wolves saw him and repeated the gesture, and every man's shoulders squared. Leovulf had spotted what he should have seen. The defenders on the wall were at the limit of their endurance, the dead finding more breaches and pulling men to their doom in ever greater numbers. Mercer raised the Runefang high, and his banner-bearer swept the flag from side to side. Now the wind caught it, and the billowing standard flew with glorious brightness against the sepulchral sky.
"That's it," said Leovulf, turning to Holstef.
Holstef raised the warhorn to his lips and blew a three-note blast. Redwayne raked back his spurs and shouted, "White Wolves, ride in the name of Ulrich!" His horse leapt forward, and 200 heavy horsemen followed him, galloping across the cobbled esplanade towards the city gate in a column 10 riders wide, 20 deep. Astern raised their banner high, and each man loosed a feral wolf howl to banish the fear they all felt as they charged towards the gate. A team of stout men hauled the gates open, but before the dead could take advantage of this new opening, Redwayne's White Wolves thundered through and struck the enemy host like a hammer blow. Marius let out a groan of pleasure as Marica rolled off him and lay back on the bed with a contented sigh. Her eyes were closed, and she purred like a satisfied cat. Blonde hair tousled with errant strands across her face. He stared at her for a moment, relishing this rare moment of escape from the world of plans, defences and warriors. Marburg was a city readying for invasion, and it felt good to take a moment for himself amid the frenetic battle preparations.
"You're staring again," she said.
"How do you know?"
he asked. "I'm a princess," she said, as though that answered his question. "If we can sense a pea in our beds, we can surely sense when a self-satisfied man is staring at us."
"Self-satisfied?" he said with mock hurt. "You have a viper's tongue, Marika."
"You weren't complaining about my tongue last night," she said, finally opening her eyes and pushing herself up onto her elbows. Marius smiled and traced his fingertips down her slender neck, over her small breasts and down her flat stomach.
"Indeed I wasn't," he agreed, "though I can't help but feel your brother wouldn't approve of the use you put it to or your choice of lover."
She laughed and rose from the bed, fetching a silver ewer filled with water. Marius stared at her naked body, the sway of her hips and the beads of sweat running down her spine, sending a tingling warmth through his entire body. She half turned and nodded. "Aldred never does," she said. "He'd have me live out my life as a virgin spinster." She laughed. "Ranald's balls! If he knew half the men I'd bedded, he'd have me locked in the Raven Tower, never to see the light of day again. And that would be a crime against the pleasures of the flesh." She padded back to the bed with a ewer and a pair of goblets, pouring one for each of them. Marius took the proffered drink and drained it in one gulping swallow. The march along the coast through the swamps had given him a terrible thirst that never seemed to be quenched. He dropped the goblet to the floor and leaned up to kiss Marika.
"Why me?" he asked suddenly.
"Why you what?"
"You know fine well what I mean," he said. "Why take me as your lover, a man your brother would cheerfully gut? Is it because I am an energetic and thoughtful bedmate with the body of an athletic god, or is it simply because I am a count of the empire?"
"A little of both," she admitted. "You are an enjoyable bed partner, but I need more than that. I need a man who can achieve things. A man who can match my dreams with an ability to shape this world to the way it ought to be." In any other woman, such candour would have surprised him. But Princess Marika had proven to be a far more interesting woman than any he had met before. She had an open honesty to her ambition that he liked, a mind free of the subterfuges and coquettish games played by most women of his acquaintance. Amid such grim times, the company of a beautiful woman free from the normal petty games of her sex was refreshing. And these times were indeed grim. In the week since the Jutones had arrived at the gates of Marburg, Marius and Aldred had clashed many times in deciding how to defend the city. He had come to believe the Endel Count wanted his city to fall. Such was his obstinate rejection of any stratagem or defensive measure Marius suggested. These interludes with Marika had provided a welcome diversion from talk of war and the dead. Marius liked to think of it as affirming the joys of life. After all, weren't sex and death but two sides of the same coin? Wasn't the moment of climax known by some poetic souls as the little more? Marika rolled onto her side, interrupting his train of thought. Her face was inches from his, and he felt the directness of her gaze. "I know what you did with Jutons, Rick," she said. "You turned a small fishing village into the most prosperous city in the Empire. Ships came from all across the world to your city."
"That they did," said Marius, knowing her flattery was intended to stroke his ego, but enjoying it nonetheless. "If there's one thing I understand, it's how to take what the gods have given me and use that to turn a coin."
"I want you to do the same with Marburg," she said. "Aldred is a good man in his own limited way, but all he wants is to maintain what our father built. Marburg is ideally placed to become as great as Jutonstrick ever was, if not greater, but only if rulers of vision are prepared to make it so. Aldred has no vision to make Marburg great, but you do."
"You might be right, but Aldred is count of the Endels, not me."
"That can change," said Marika.
"How?"
"If you and I were to be married," she said, leaning forward to kiss him. Now it was Marius's turn to laugh. He rolled onto his back, pillowing his head on his hands.
"That's your plan. Your brother would never allow it."
Man and thunder, he'd have my manhood on a spike if he thought I'd even kissed you, let alone bedded you.
Aldred won't be count forever, she said. After all, if what you've been saying in the war councils is true, then this city is likely to be attacked soon by these undead corsairs. Aldred's a decent enough warrior, but anything can happen in a battle, can't it?
Marius turned to look at Marica, his eyes narrowing as he saw the extent of her ambition. It matched his own, and he felt the stirrings of opportunity.
"What are you suggesting?" he asked.
"Suggesting," she said, pulling the sheet down and rolling on top of him.
She sat up, allowing his eyes to feast on the seductive curves of her body.
"I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just saying that if something were to happen to Aldred, then there would be nothing to stop you marrying me and becoming lord of all the lands from here to Manon's Teeth."
Marius slid his hands up her sides and cupped her breasts with a smile.
"You are a cunning fox, aren't you?" said Marius. "Takes one to know one," she said.
Redwing crushed skeletal warriors in crumbling iron armour beneath his horse, swinging his hammer in a mighty underhand arc that smashed collarbones, broke shoulders apart, and sent skulls flying. His horse trampled the dead beneath its hooves. To either side of him, Leovulf, Ustern, and Holstef fought with brute ferocity as they battered a path down the viaduct, winning Mercer and Renward time to move up fresh warriors and relieve those who had fought to exhaustion. "Holstef, spearhead!" bellowed Redwane, and the clarion blew a long, rising blast. The white wolves smoothly formed a wedge on Redwane, pushing hard into the choking, massed ranks of the dead. Redwane lost himself in the simple purity of this fight, bludgeoning the dead with his hammer and letting his horse kick and crush his enemies with wild abandon. He heard screams around him as grasping, skeletal hands dragged warriors from their saddles, or screeching things with elongated jaws and red eyes tore the throats from horses to spill their riders to the ground. Their charge was slowing, the press of dead warriors too great for even the mighty white wolves to smash through. And as they slowed, more of Redwane's warriors were falling to the blades of the dead. A fiery-eyed wolf leapt towards him, and Redwane swayed in the saddle, intercepting the beast's open jaws with his hammer. Its head split apart, and its corpse slammed into him. Its dissolving body unraveled, looping rotted guts spilling into his lap, and stagnant fluids hissing as they burned his armour.
"Time to go," shouted Leovulf.
Redwane nodded and turned to shout at Holstef to sound the retreat, but the saddle next to him was empty. He circled his horse, finally seeing Holstef pinned to the ground by a scabrous ghoul with foam-flecked jaws and needle-sharp talons. Holstef screamed as it tore his guts out, its arms bloody to the elbows as it disemboweled the white wolf. Redwane hauled back on his reins, and his horse reared up onto its hind legs. Its hooves flailed as it came down, crushing the creature beneath its weight, though it was too late to save Holstef. The white wolves fought on, the dead pressing in from all around as the sheer number of skeletal warriors finally arrested their charge. The viaduct was choked with the debris of the fighting, a welter of bones, rusted armour, and leering skulls. Though it was probably suicide, Redwane leapt from the saddle and dropped to the ground beside Holstef. The man was already dead, his ruptured stomach steaming in the cold air. Redwane reached for the war horn. Unless he blew the retreat, the white wolves were as good as dead. An armoured foot slammed down on the horn, shattering it into fragments, and Redwane leapt aside as a black sword slashed towards him. He rolled to his feet, swinging his hammer up to block a descending blow. The force of the blow rang up his arms, and emerald sparks flew from the impact. He backed away, taking in the measure of his opponent as he fought the rising tide of fearful bile in his throat. Redwane's heart chilled as he saw he faced a dead knight in black armour, who was shawled in a cloak woven from nightmares and woe. Its sword and armour were archaic, coated in grave dirt and rust, though the lambent glow that surrounded the ancient warlord told Redwane that this was a champion of the dead, a supreme killer of the living. It wore an open helm, and the green fire in its eyes promised a death as quick as it would be meaningless. Its sword swung for his neck, and Redwayne threw himself back as it attacked with a speed and skill no living swordsman could match. Without a shield, Redwayne could only block and parry with his hammer, but no matter how skillful, a fight between sword and hammer could only end badly for him. The champion's blade slipped past his guard, and Redwayne screamed as its icy tip punched through his armour and slid between his ribs. Numbing waves of cold spread from the wound, and Redwayne's heart stilled as the blade twisted in the wound. He staggered away from the champion, and no sooner had its sword scraped free of his armour than his heart thumped painfully in his chest. The dread champion came at him again, but before he could strike him down, a black horse slammed into it, sending it crashing back against the viaduct's parapet. Leofulf reached down and extended his hand towards Redwayne as the champion climbed to its feet, broken bones knitting together once more and its grinning skull welcoming fresh meat to slay.
"We can't fight it," gasped Redwayne.
"I know," shouted Leofulf. "Get on!"
Redwayne grasped Leofulf's hand, hauling himself painfully onto the horse's rump. The dead were closing in, and Redwayne feared that Leofulf's horse would never make it with two heavily armed warriors on its back. The dead champion strode towards them, but it had taken only a handful of steps before it halted, as though sensing a greater threat than the two warriors before it. Redwayne's entire body was cold, his flesh icy and grey from the wound dealt to him. But a deeper cold swept over him as the sound of winter gales howled from the forests. Swirling snowflakes and fragments of ice slashed from the sky, and the dead paused in their relentless attack as a surging wind roared up the viaduct, echoing with the howls of wolves. The chorus of lupine fury was utterly without mercy, and Redwayne watched in amazement as a blizzard of winter wind blew over the dead warlord who had so nearly slain him. Ice formed on its ancient armour and decaying flesh as the chill wind froze the champion in place. A bitter squall of hail tore at it like a storm of razed glass, and a deafening howl of winter's fury broke its bones apart in an explosion of long-dead remains. The dead parted as something pushed its way up from the ground, a hulking figure in thick wolf pelts and cloaked in a blizzard of freezing ice. He carried a long staff that shimmered with hoarfrost and was topped with a glittering blade of ice. A wolf skull mask obscured his face, and his heavily muscled limbs were bare to the elements, though he seemed to feel no ill effects from the deathly cold. Two wolves loped through the motionless dead as he stalked towards them, one pale as moonlight, the other black as jet. The fighting on the viaduct ceased, and the white wolves drew together as the wolf-clad warrior stopped before them.
"The fire of Ulric calls me," he said, his voice echoing as though coming from the furthest reaches of the frozen north.
Redwayne had seen this warrior once before, at the coronation of Sigmar in Reichdorf, and a wave of frozen pain washed through him.
"Ah, Ulric!" cried Leofulf. "Ah, Ulric has come!"